Okay. Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of hope and the podcast of solutions. I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and joined today by Martin. Martin, how are you?
Not too bad. Just like to remind everybody, tortoise shack, stick your hand in your pocket, join the platform, be part of the family. You can go on to Patreon. .com/tortoiseshack. Price of a cup of coffee, you get these genuinely brilliant podcasts from Rory.
Exactly. No, we really encourage people. We need to keep the money coming in order to keep these podcasts going out. So if you're liking them, please stick your hand in your pocket and help us out. Today, we're delighted to be joined by Tricia Keelty, Head of Social Justice and Policy with St. Vincent de Paul and also an adjunct professor in UCD. Tricia, thanks again for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
And also, first time on Reboot Republic, it's the, how would I describe him, the wonderful Ciarán Nugent from the Nevin Economic Research Institute. Ciarán, I'm delighted to have you on.
I'll take it. Thanks, million, Rory. Thanks for inviting me.
Great. I'm looking forward to it. Today's discussion, what we're going to go into and chat about, is the recently released statistics and figures on poverty and income and deprivation in Ireland. And they are called it's the Survey on Income and Living Conditions, otherwise shorthand called the SILC. And it's a household survey done by the CSO. And what was quite significant of the findings released this week, and these figures are for 2019, and we'll come on to discuss what we think will be the implications of COVID, but these are pre-COVID indicators, showed that a significant increase across a number of groups, including private renters, lone parents, in terms of deprivation. So to discuss this, we're going to have a chat and kind of go through some of the figures and trying to get our head around what actually this tells us about inequality and poverty in Ireland today. Tricia, if I go to you first, maybe you could take us through some of the kind of key kind of standout indicators and changes in deprivation and these figures, please.
Yeah, so enforced deprivation refers to people who are going without basics like nutritious food, adequate heating, or suitable clothing. It also refers to things like being unable to replace worn out furniture, or you're not able to have a birthday party for a family member. So it incorporates not just basics, but also kind of broader aspects of social inclusion, so that you're able to participate in society. And I suppose what's quite striking and shocking, I suppose, is the number of people in Ireland who are actually going without these basics and who are experiencing social exclusion. So the figures actually equate to almost 900,000 people who are going without these basics. And I think what was very surprising, I suppose, well, maybe not surprising to us in Vincent de Paul, but that it actually increased between 2018 and 2019 for everyone, for the population. So about 140,000 extra people, 140,000 extra people were going without in 2019 when compared to 2018. So at a time when the economy was doing well, when unemployment was decreasing, and prior to the pandemic, which has obviously exacerbated these issues for many people, deprivation was increasing. And as you mentioned there, some of the largest increases were among those in the private rented sector. And I suppose that's not really surprising for SVP members, because we've seen in recent years that housing costs are really driving poverty and financial hardship among low-income households in particular. So those who may be receiving HAP, the housing assistance payment, and paying a top-up to their landlord so that it's in line with market rents. And what people tend to do is their first priority is to keep a roof over their head, obviously. So they'll then cut back on the basics like food, like heating. And that's why it's not really surprising to see such a substantial increase in deprivation among those who are renters. So over 34% of renters are now experiencing deprivation.
Which is up from 27% in 2018, which is a very big jump.
Yeah, so it's a large increase. And the other group, you know, that has seen a very large increase is lone parents. Again, this is a group that has experienced poverty very high levels of poverty for many years, and it's a group of households and people in our society that policy has failed and continues to fail. And I think the fact that almost one in four children are now or were experiencing deprivation prior to the pandemic is quite a shocking figure as well. So to put it in another way, if you have a class of 30 students, seven of those children are going to school. Maybe they haven't had breakfast. Maybe they don't have the right material to learn. They don't have the books. They don't have a uniform that fits properly. And they may not be able to take part in school trips because they can't afford it, and they feel excluded and they feel different. And that really has an impact not only on their educational outcomes, but also like their social well-being and their mental health as well. So it's really worrying that prior to the pandemic, which has exacerbated and really impacted children, that so many were experiencing deprivation. So I think, you know, I hope this is a wake-up call and we can see a focus on it when the government return fully in the next couple of weeks, because it's really not acceptable, these figures.
Thanks, Tricia. Yeah, and we'll come on to discuss that as well in terms of we are heading into the budget period now in October. Within a few weeks, we're going to require a budget. And so the question would be, what measures should be introduced to address these? Ciarán, what was your kind of analysis of some of the figures that were jumping out to you, or kind of what did you think of the significance of them?
Well, they're tied in to something Tricia was talking about there with renters. So I got a breakdown from the CSO at a more finer detail in terms of the age breakdowns. So you see, as Tricia mentioned, you know, deprivation, being unable to afford basic necessities, went up for children by about 4 points, up to 23-24%. But the other two groups were the 18-24s and the 25-34 year old groups, both of whom are about one in five now are in deprivation, and they've the among the highest rates of deprivation of any age group. And these are the same group who really felt the brunt of the financial crisis, and really the effects of the financial crisis were still, you know, this group was still experiencing them in 2019. And you can see that in some of the indicators of say precarious work, like temporary contracts, part-time work, they ticked up slightly for under 30s in 2018 and 2019. And even though we heard a lot about you know, strong wage growth the last couple of years, strong wage growth in 2018 was about 3.5%. It still didn't keep up with the rising costs of rent. So you can see that reflected now, and you know, kind of the discourse now is talking about for a while it was, you know, we need to reimagine the social contract, and there's been a paradigm shift with the intervention of the state, and then we're kind of back to talking about you know, austerity and tourism, and this is a worry going forward, especially that this isn't even picking up, as you said, the impact of COVID, which has also been disproportionately felt by these groups.
Yeah, I think that's there's some really important points, and I was looking at it as well, and struck by the increase in the rental accommodation. And then if you look at the percentage of owner-occupiers who were in deprivation, the figure was static. There was no change. And so you're really seeing how the housing crisis is impacting, and it's impacting, as you say, particularly in terms of generation rent, the younger people, and you've obviously found that in terms of statistics. The other thing I was struck by was that 70% of the population experienced none of these, but 30% did. And that those who experience three or more of the aspects, types of deprivation, that the number of those experiencing that increased. So essentially what we're seeing is that this kind of inequality growing. Would you agree with that, Tricia, that those who are kind of affected by deprivation are becoming more affected by it?
Yes, absolutely. And I think as I mentioned, a lot of that is to do with how people's housing needs are being met at the moment. And if it's been met through the private rented sector, people's disposable income is just being ate up by rents, and then people have nothing left to meet the basics. And then if you are lucky enough to own your own home and you don't have that maybe additional pressure of being subject to market fluctuations, then you're in a much more stable, better off position. And I think we are also seeing just a generational divide, as Kieran mentioned as well. And I think that the pandemic has really shown, you know, the impact of the job losses have been primarily on those in low paid sectors, those households who are renting, those households who already maybe have higher levels of debt, non-mortgage or non-housing related debt, but just debt for basics, and also those who have no savings. So we are seeing a divide open up, and I think there was progress being made, but I feel like we're obviously taking a big step back now with the pandemic. Unless, you know, it's not too late, there can be ways of mitigating the impact, and the measures can be implemented now, and it needs to be done now to prevent the longer term damage of it.
Kieran, in terms of generational, we'll say, workplace, the issue of precarious work and, you know, the young people experiencing, you know, both in terms of short-term contracts, but lower wages. And you've, you know, described it here back in 2019 in another world, as we said, when the economy was booming pre-COVID. Why was this so, why were we seeing this rising deprivation amongst these younger groups if they were in work and they would have been receiving pay? Was it the issue of low pay or low hours, or what was going on?
Well, it's basically that wages haven't really recovered for those younger groups, and it's the mismatch, as we said, with housing. I mean, they've almost recovered, but rents are way higher than they were in 2008, and so that mismatch. I mean, we're talking about, you know, €1,400 for co-living development is the most recent plan that we've heard about. And if you just do the simple maths on that, that takes 30 hours at the minimum wage to cover that rent every week. So it's like that, as long as that mismatch continues, as long as one is growing faster than the other, we're going to see people having, as Tricia said, having to make choices about what to buy. And, you know, you heard that there was a representative of Retail Ireland on yesterday on the news of one, talking about the effects on even retail. So if you're, obviously, if your wages are only covering 30, 40, 50% of the rent, that you're going to be making decisions that affect the high street and affect, you know, even kind of some of the sectors hit their accommodation and food, you're not going to have that excess money, and it's going to be, you know, grabbed by landlords and going to affect other parts of the economy as well.
And yeah, I looked at figures immediately after the financial collapse, when jobs started, when you would expect that precarious work would reduce, the you know, they'd be the first out the door and the employees with good status would be kept. But actually, the reverse was true. A lot of employees were forced into contract work with subsequent wage losses. And I'm getting lots of anecdotal evidence that that's going on right now, that people are being told that their permanent job is gone, but they can work as a contractor on less money. Does that feed into it?
Yeah, I mean, well, now through COVID, that is definitely, like, those things are going to start happening. I mean, there's going to be way more people competing for less jobs, especially in the next year. There's going to be pressure to even probably reduce the minimum wage, which is, you know, unsustainable in the context of what I was just talking about in terms of rent. And so, yeah, there's a battle on there coming. There's 100,000 more under 18 to 24 year olds on some kind of assistance payment, whether it's the wage subsidy or the PUP, than there were this time last year. And nobody knows what the future holds, and this will be a time. We've seen what's happened in Aer Lingus, in British Airways, trying to hire people back on lower conditions, lower wages. This will be, if the big companies are doing that so publicly, I mean, it's going to happen across the economy, and these, you know, it doesn't bode well in terms of standards of living, in terms of especially this focus on tourism, which is, you know, the worst employment of any sector in Ireland by a country mile, in terms of, not just in terms of temporary contracts, part-time work, but wages as well. The average wages in accommodation field is €350 a week. So this is got this kind of low wage model, which, you know, as I said earlier, we thought was going to be reimagined, and maybe, you know, there were talks of maybe we'll transition to a more high wage, high productive model like they'll have in Denmark and Sweden and Germany. But this doesn't seem to be on the cards, and there's it's all getting back to normal. But of course, getting back to normal was not working for a huge share of people in our society, and particularly those under the age of 40. So it's a worrying time at the moment.
Tricia, in terms of lone parents, why the lone parent deprivation rate at 45%, the highest of any household? We're saying basically a half of lone parent families are suffering from enforced deprivation. Could you outline why this is so high for this particular group?
There's a couple of reasons. And I think also important to say, because often these stats are compared to other European countries and we're seen as being doing okay relative to other European countries, which in itself is probably not a very useful argument, because, you know, people are struggling and there's always people behind these statistics. But when you look at lone parents and the living standards of lone parents, we have one of the highest rates of persistent poverty, severe deprivation among EU 28 countries. So lone parents in Ireland are really struggling and have some of the worst living standards across Europe. And if you look at countries that have lower rates of poverty among one-parent families, what they tend to have is highly subsidised childcare, the availability of affordable housing, and they have flexible work arrangements, and they have an adequate pay floor for women in particular, and a gender reflection of that within a very gender-inclusive labour market. Ireland has none of those, really. And that's why policy has failed lone parents and their children, and why poverty continues to be so high. And I suppose we published a report a year ago which looked at working lone parents. And during the recovery, poverty among lone parents who are working more than doubled. And that can be linked back to a policy decision during the recession that sought to cut the support for lone parents who are working part-time, because part-time work, because childcare isn't always available, is the best option for lone parents. And they rolled back a lot of those supports, income supports for lone parents who were working part-time, and as a result, working poverty more than increased. So now we're facing into a situation where the risk of long-term unemployment is increasing again, because lone parents may not be able to go back to work, and we're hearing from parents who can't because their creche isn't open fully. They're worried about what will happen if the school has to close because there's a local outbreak and they have to give up work as a result, and they have to take time off work. They can't afford unpaid leave, so they're being forced out of the labour market. We're also hearing from parents who would have received the working family payment, which is an income support for people in low-paid work, for families in low-paid work, and they're now on reduced hours, and they're not meeting the hour requirement for that payment, so they've lost it. So there's a huge impact. So we're concerned that as we emerge from this crisis and into an economic crisis, that lone parents are going to be left behind. So we're really trying to make sure that that doesn't happen again.
And do you think that this is still related to societal and political kind of conservative, we were politics dominated, not just politics, but government and the state dominated by historically, you know, a very stigmatized view of lone parents, that this still runs through our policy and institutions and welfare system? Or do you think it's more generally the lack of kind of a patriarchal state that is still very much based on a charity model that doesn't actually provide, as you say, proper childcare, that it's broader than just the stigmatization of lone parents? Or what's your sense of that?
It's definitely a combination of those. You know, this is a historic failure. It's not a recent failure. And stigma certainly still persists for lone parent families. But it is that because, you know, 84% of lone parents are women. And it is a gender equality issue. And it is the fact that we have a male breadwinner model of social protection and social welfare. And while there has been positive improvements in recent years, we just haven't got to grips with that or moved away from that model. And unless we have a specific gender equality emphasis in our anti-poverty policies and in the design of public policies, our best efforts to address poverty among lone parents will be blunted.
And Ciarán, do you think that, you know, what you talked about, this generational divide, the generational equality, you know, that we're seeing in terms of precarious work issues in the labour force, combined with the housing market, that in with rents and generation rent, that what we're likely to see then, you know, if we look to what's currently going on right now, and of course, it's a big pity that these are, you know, household surveys are only done every year in a way, in the midst of such a crisis. You know, it would be good to have an understanding of what's going on right now, but we're likely to see the deprivation figures jump significantly next year, particularly amongst those same groups.
I think without a doubt. Now, obviously the PUP helped cushion that, but they've already started cutting that back, unfortunately, and that will affect, because it was about the cutbacks are related to what the earnings were beforehand. A lot of that precarious low wage work was younger people. So I think without a doubt, we're going to see that that deprivation go up on average over the year. And I worry about that. There's no, as we were saying earlier on, there's no pressure valve of immigration this time around. This is the most educated generation in the history of the state. They expect a return to the investments that they've put into their education. And if all that's being offered at the moment is low wage seasonal work in tourism, you know, I think there's problems for the future, especially when people are so precarious with the housing situation as well. You know, Dáil Éireann have produced a couple of papers on, you know, Green New Deal, state intervention, moving towards European norms of taxation in terms of employers, PSI, etc., to pay for, you know, like at the moment, it's a difficult time to argue for a living wage just with SMEs and the position they're in at the moment, but we could tackle the other side in terms of the cost of living, in terms of housing, as we mentioned, childcare, public transport, and give that all a green tint, to provide some kind of, you know, hope for the future. At the moment, I don't, like, you know, the signals are not good in terms, like, there's, I think that there was a psychological impact of this crisis that we haven't had compared to the last one. What I mean by that is there's no dole queues on the 6-1 news. And I think there's hundreds of thousands of people sitting at home with nothing to do at the moment that really haven't been vox popped on RT. They're not really getting their vote. I think there's a disconnect there to what's happening out there. And in terms of, you know, what does the future hold? What's the long term strategy to get us away from, you know, our development model, which is precarious as well, to provide, you know, somehow for the future? It's worrying on that end, and the deprivation rates like that, of course, will throw up other social issues, depression, mental health issues, all that kind of stuff. So it'll definitely go up, and there's much more of a requirement than trying to save tourism on this government, and hopefully the budget will reflect that in October, and that we'll be hearing more of a plan, a long-term plan for all those people sitting at home at the moment.
I kind of have to agree with Tricia. I see this as a particularly for lone parents, it is historical, and there is always an element of punishment with Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael when it comes to lone parents. They are always punished in some way for being lone parents, and everything feeds off that. The fact that there is no affordable childcare is just more punishment on lone parents. How do we change that mindset? I don't think we can with the administration that exists. I think it would take a different administration with a completely different outlook. I don't think there's anything they're going to do in a budget that's going to particularly help lone parents or particularly help those who are going into deprivation. Their focus is going to be very much on jobs, on the headline figure of how many people are off the unemployment register, and they really don't care how they do that. If it's 1 hour a week at €8, that's you gone, and they don't want to know after that. That's their headline figure. Part of the problem too is that we expect these headline figures. We feed into them. If you can reduce employment by 5%, nobody says, what kind of jobs are you creating? It's just that the 5% has been reduced. So it's up to us as individuals to demand more accountability for the kind of work that's been created as well.
See, Martin, that's what you call dead silence.
I'll have to cut that out.
I just think we should leave that and not cut that. That just like, it was worthy of that moment of silence where we all should sit and reflect after Father Martin gives his sermon.
Well, I think
everyone was in 100% agreement.
Yeah. I think we do need to reflect. We need to reflect on that the headline figure of unemployment coming down, that's going to be the figure for the next 5 years. That's going to be the important figure. But how actually important is that figure when you break it down? What's the quality of jobs being created? Mm-hmm. Are lone parents getting a shot at decent work, at decent childcare? And that's each one of us individually has to say, well, I don't really care how much unemployment has reduced unless they're good jobs that they're going to. And that's us.
I think you're absolutely right. And I was quite struck by what you said, Ciarán, there as well, about the psychological impact and that kind of hidden kind of impact of this crisis, that, you know, that you're right, there's no, you know, hundreds of thousands in dole queues, there's no, you know, speaking to the people who are sitting at home, who've, you know, I know friends who've, you know, who've lost, for example, mortgage applications, who've lost, you know, their whole life is on hold now. You've got, as you say, you know, generational impact, you know, what it means again by this, again, personally talking to my teenage son about this, and kind of I was asking about, you know, why is anxiety increasing so much amongst young people? And he was talking about it, like, what is our hope? You know, you've got a generation hit by, as you say, a financial crash in 2008. And now there's this other, you know, crash happening, and they go, what's our prospects? You know, what lies ahead for us? And there has to be massive, you know what I mean, mental health impacts of all this.
Yeah, it's a worry, and the best way to tackle that is through, you know, decent work, which, you know, has meaning in it. I think that's another thing with this generation that is, it's important for them. So we've been pushing for, as I said, a Green New Deal. I think that's an issue that's more important for younger people. Clearly, it's an issue that's more important for younger people than older voters, or older politicians, or older commentariat, etc. So this is an opportunity, I think, for us. There's a few open goals there, and we've written about you've written about this, Rory, in terms of the problems with nobody signing up for apprenticeships in the traditional trades. And we were kind of pushing for an apprenticeship program with a job guarantee for a public state-led retrofit program, which it's such an open goal. It's so easy. There's so many external kind of benefits to it for on an individual household level as well as on a macro level, and to promote that kind of decent work into the future. You know, we've got a case in Bournemouth in the Midlands, you know, where we're pushing for a just transition, and you can tell it's not a just transition. Part of it means decent work, and they're already talking about, you know, call centers and stuff like this. And you know, when they're talking about call centers, it means they don't really have a plan, you know. And so it's about, obviously the private sector haven't been doing it, or at least not to the extent that's needed in terms of matching education with decent employment. And that has to be the task of this government and successive governments is to, you know, underpin that through, you know, more investment in education, more investment in research and development, and more state intervention in general. So we were pushing for the retrofit program as kind of middle income, decent jobs, also, you know, green energy, renewables on the West Coast. You can of course, there's regional dimensions to these deprivation indicators as well. Even the employment for there were some regions with the LFS data there last week were hit harder than others. So there are things that the government can do, but ideologically, I think there's a barrier there in terms of, you know, it's still smaller state private sector, and we're kind of arguing for a rebalance of that. With a medium to long term plan, with decent work, sustainability, inclusivity, and productivity at its base, and that's the best thing to do for these issues around mental health is to provide meaning and decent employment and a decent standard of living for younger generations.
Can I just to add to that, I think another vitally important component, if we're talking about addressing poverty and deprivation, and if we're heading into a period where unemployment will be high, is that the pandemic really has shown that the inadequacy of our social welfare rate, of it, that it's fine for someone to live on 203 a week, but actually, no, we need to make it 350 because people can't live on that. So we really need to have a discussion around the adequacy of our social welfare system. What we've been arguing for many years is that it should be benchmarked against the cost of a minimum essential standard of living, which is derived from the research from the Vincentian Partnership of Social Justice. So that's really reflective of the actual cost people are faced with, the real household costs that people are faced with. So it's not just arbitrary. And I think that is really preventative, because obviously it costs money to expenditure on social protection is the biggest spend the government makes, but it has a huge return on investment, because if people are living on an adequate income every day, if they're experiencing deprivation, that has a big impact on, as Kieran said, on your mental health, on your physical health, and on children's long-term outcomes. And, you know, we had that research published earlier this year on the cost of poverty. And it's huge amount. It's 4.5 billion euro that's spent every year dealing with the damage that poverty causes. So as we're facing into a budget, which will be about, well, we can't invest in that because we need to do this. There's always choices. So it's about making the choices that benefit people on the lowest incomes and also create jobs. But also we can't forget about people who are on social welfare, because that's usually the last of the priorities.
In terms of the budget, and we're going into now the budget kind of circus in many ways, because I think it's, you know, Kieran kind of outlined the need for a kind of macro change in vision. Is it possible to get that macro change in vision brought into the budget discussions and the actual budget policies?
It's always been a challenge because it's just an annual budget. What you really need is multi-annual budgets that are tied to overall structural strategies and policies, because year on year, it's very hard to get any kind of sustained change, particularly on issues like poverty that do require actions over the lifetime of a number of governments who really want to eliminate poverty, which is the ultimate goal as set out by the Sustainable Development Goals. And I think you do get pulled into, well, just kind of shorter term measures, plugging gaps, addressing the symptoms rather than the causes of a lot of the social issues that we would see anyway in terms of Vincent de Paul's work. So I do think there is very key investments that can be made in this budget that will be make a difference, and preventative measures as well. And I think that's really firstly about increasing social welfare. You know, that it's usually the first thing that's cut when times are tough, but this is the time where you increase it to prevent the damage that long-term income inadequacy causes for people. You need to increase particularly child payments as well, because, you know, child poverty is a persistent issue, and they need income supports. And it's also about, you know, you can make smart investments into things like childcare that reach people on the lowest incomes first. And then also, as Ciara mentioned, there's really key investments that can be made in the areas of energy that would not only help address climate action objectives, but also energy poverty as well, which is a persistent issue as well that affects many households.
Ciarán, what do you think are the kind of key things that we should see in the budget measures that would make a difference?
Yeah, well, as Tricia was saying there, because they're, you know, yearly budgets, I was saying medium to long-term strategy in terms of, you know, bringing us up to European norms. The director, Tom McDonnell, and a colleague, Paul Galdra-Kelly, have outlined areas of where we fall short of European norms in terms of revenue raising, employers, PRSI, you know, net wealth tax, inheritance tax, things like that can, you know, promote equality and equal outcomes, as well as raising revenue and using that to increase the welfare state in terms of childcare, in terms of public transport, in terms of housing, of course, cost rental model or whatever. But in the short term, we're facing into a year, we're facing into a long winter, and without prospects for a lot of people, and we have carbon reduction targets to hit, and we'll be getting fined if we don't. So in the short term, we'd like there could be and we were talking about mental health issues there as well, and getting out. We were talking inside about a mass tree planting program for the next 12 months or so. You keep your PUP at €350 maybe, and through local authorities or something like that. That is, it's voluntary, obviously. Young people can go out. It doesn't have to be young people, but I just think young people would jump at that opportunity, especially if there's nothing else going on. You can socially distance, etc. And we can do a lot of work in it with a short-term program. Obviously, there's no long-term prospects, really, in terms of decent work and stuff like that. But getting us through the next year, you could, you know, two birds with one stone, three birds with one stone, or whatever. And, of course, you know, but with a plan as well set out for us to get away from our reliance on corporation tax. Last year, we might possibly be making the same mistake as we did in 2008 with our reliance on property receipts, revenue from property receipts. And at the moment with corporation tax, there's a mystery. You know, the last announcement, the corporation tax, there was an extra $1.5 billion, something like that, and no, there's a mystery where it came from. So we're reliant on that at the moment, and what we have to do is plan in the long term to get away from that, because that could just, we don't know if the plug could be pulled on that at any moment. So we need a broader base in terms of our revenue, and that involves a transition to, as I said, European norms in terms of taxation and welfare floors in terms of housing, childcare, and public transport, health, of course, as well. We didn't get onto that, but anyway.
Great, Ciarán. Yeah, just before we finish, I know, Tricia, you wanted to highlight something that you've been involved in around homelessness and poverty, and you want to talk for a few minutes about it.
Yeah, so many people might have seen Focus launched a campaign called Childcare Prevents Homelessness, and we're supporting it along with other organisations like One Family, Bernardo's. And I suppose it, prior to the budget, a number of key measures need to be made to prevent lone parents becoming long-term unemployed, a deepening of child poverty and the risk of family homelessness. So we'd like to make sure that people, if they can't access or return to work because of childcare, because of school closures, that there's adequate income supports available to them, whether that be the continuation of PUP at the 350 rate or accessing illness benefit if your child has to isolate because there's an outbreak at school. So very simple measures that would really be very preventative, because even just a temporary loss of income for lone parents can put them at risk of homelessness. And I know the new regulation, legislation, if you are in rent arrears, you may not be evicted, but there's lots of ways around that. And now that that's been lifted, we're really fearful that there will be a rise in homelessness. So the campaign, you can sign up for the campaign, and we'll be doing some more work around that in the coming days and weeks, because it's a really important issue.
What's the address for the campaign, Tricia?
The hashtag is Childcare Prevents Homelessness, and it's on Focus Ireland's website if you want to sign the petition as well.
Yeah. Thank you. Just want to remind everybody that this coming Sunday we do our live podcast at noon, where we look at the subjects of the week. It's good audience participation, good guest participation. Come along, and we'd be delighted to have everybody there. Back to you, Rory.
Thanks, Martin. And thank you so much, Ciarán and Tricia, for joining us today. There was a really, really good discussion and a lot to think about, and encourage you to support the campaigns. And we'll have you back in the next couple of weeks before the budget, and to analyse the budget, if that's all okay.
Absolutely.
Great. Thanks a million. And listen, don't forget, you can sign up to support Reboot Republic and the other podcasts on tortoiseshack.ie. Become a patron, support us to keep going. Thank you very much.